And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being a land of opportunity. And maybe Neil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Welcome, welcome to the Three Left Show. I am your host, Dan Platt, live here in the studio. Do not want to screw up. So, welcome to this live edition of the Saturday edition Talk Radio here in Albany, New York. I'm your host, Dan Platt. I said that already, but that's fine. Just getting started. Just waking up. Hopefully I'm helping go to help you wake up by taking you on a journey. I've got quite a show planned, so to speak. I have an outline of stories. The first hour will be sort of focused on taking you through marginal perspectives that are ideological ones. So, part of being a well-rounded thinking person to me, well-informed, and just generally more empathetic and more broad and not less likely to fall into dogmatic and other kinds of traps, is to look at things through another perspective, or at least taking seriously marginal ideologies. I'm going to first do a story from an editor of a pretty well-put-together news magazine, Current Affairs. Then I'm going to go through kind of the dueling perspectives of it. There are basically two dueling socialist orgs that are both like a few dozen socialists arguing with another few dozen socialists. Why would I talk about that, though? Because I feel that the marginal is the future. Even if it seems like their actions are inconsequential, I think there are implications of tactics and strategy, maybe to learn what they're not doing, is the usual lesson. Because too many shows that, let's say, aren't mainstream but still rather popular on the left, comes to mind is Michael Brooks, Jimmy Dore, other YouTubers with good YouTube shows. It still really irks me how they kind of erase other ways of doing things, and they go like, they ignore, like, unless, they ignore all corners unless they have, quote-unquote, a shot at being president. If you don't have a shot at being president, they completely ignore anything that could be said, any policy, any proposals, any programs, as if there's nothing to learn. And that really bothers me, like, a lot, to the point where I consider Michael Brooks, like, I don't like him. I think his personality is icky in ways. He's a little funny. He's very smart, right? But I think there's a wisdom that's lacking. Not so that like you're like not in the way that like your head's always so open. You're so open-minded that you let anything in. But I think there are things to learn in a broader sense, especially when it comes to fighting the grand narratives. I think it's pretty interesting. Slash, you know, ironic, whatever you want to call it, that postmodernism, boilerplate defined as being the rejection of grand narratives, that there are these grand narratives about gender, about our country, so it's rejecting nationalism, a rejection of grand narratives. Yet, in our postmodern society, as it's called, there are actually many grand narratives that go unquestioned. Grand narratives like, if you are a communist or a lefty of any, you know, if you're just lefty and you take your idea seriously, then you are A, authoritarian, or that you're going to be authoritarian, or that as soon as you get power, it will be revealed that you are authoritarian, even if you say you aren't. So I guess that could apply to who I'm going to read next, as well as myself. Power doesn't really corrupt, it reveals. I really like that line. Whatever you're going to do or say you're going to do, and you get power, and that's what you end up, that's what you do, because power actually allows you to do what you want. Way to go figure. So let's jump right in, because I have, I don't want to get bogged down too much. I want to fill the hour effectively. So this is from 2 years ago, actually, but it's still relevant, of course, because that's the kind of content that I do on this show. So I actually didn't explain the show yet. This is the Three Lefts. These lefts are representative of flags, ideologies. Black for anarchism, red for socialism, and green for ecology. All three, to me, are needed. I am very flexible, as well as, what does it call it? Not interdisciplinary, but multi-tendency is the term. I don't stick to one line about what is the best way, although I do have certain leanings, which will come through as I read things and I give my own takes as I read off of these other fine writers, because I don't consider it sloth that I don't want to write a new essay for every episode of the show when there are other people who write just even better than me and make the points that I would like to make, and then I just add my own flavor. So this is How to Be a Socialist Without Being an Apologist for the Atrocities of Communist Regimes. So, grand narrative that, especially from the right, but it's just well accepted, that 20th century regimes are just the worst. Nothing good ever came from them. There's nothing to learn. They're dustbin of history, because they collapsed. They were beaten. We won, guys. That's a joke. So, I guess that's that, right? That's quite reductionary. So let's not get ourselves backed in a corner right here. So this is opposing. So I'm going to start with this as a preface, because the next few things I'm going to read are about socialists who are basically fighting over the legacy of 20th century regimes, socialist ones, as well as the current state of the surviving socialist states / communist regimes, which there are very few. I think you can list them on one hand. And they come up in the news, as they have in the last year. Usually we threaten to invade them, nuke them, destroy them, in the name of saving their people. Yeah, it's very consistent. So this is by Nathan Robinson. He is the editor of Current Affairs, and that's where I'm reading this from. He's a writer of his own right. He has his own books. Rather, the books are collections of essays that he has written, because that's what they do. I will start. It's incredibly easy to be both in favor of socialism and against the crimes committed by the 20th century communist regimes. All it takes is a consistent principled opposition to authoritarianism. I don't like it when bosses mistreat and abuse their workers. I don't like it when governments mistreat and abuse their people. A system in which people must work for low wages, struggling to afford housing, health care, education, is abhorrent and should be gotten rid of. A system in which people must either work or be sent to forced re-education camps, as they're called, is even more abhorrent, or just as abhorrent. We can dream of a world that has neither gulags nor indentured servitude, and I am such a romantic idealist that I believe such a world might even be possible. Maybe even probable. So he, like many kinds of essays like this, they work off of someone else writing about them. Or at least a straw man version of them. Straw man being a fake propped up version who is not representative. So, so he's working off of Brett Stevens of the New York Times, who wants to convince readers that the choice is binary, that millennials who criticize contemporary capitalism, that's me, have forgotten the history of the 20th century. But personally, if I might humble brag, it's not humble brag, brag that I've probably studied 20th century history more than any of these columnists. They know that Nazis and apartheid South Africa were bad, but they don't have the same horror at Stalinism and the Khmer Rouge. Why is Marxism still taken seriously on college campuses and in the progressive press? Stephens asks, do the same people who rightly demand the removal of Confederate statues ever feel even a shiver of inner revulsion at hipsters in Lenin and Mao t-shirts? Leftists, Stephens says, engage in excuse-making. They justify atrocities committed by revolutionaries, and that they would condemn if those same acts were committed by capitalists. Quote, they will insist that there is an essential difference between Nazism and communism, between race hatred and class hatred. Buchenwald and the Gulag. Buchenwald being one of the death camps for Jews in the Holocaust. And they morally favor the latter. They will attempt to disassociate communist theory, which I preach on this show, from practice in an effort to acquit the former. They will balance acknowledgement of the repression and mass murder of communism with references to its real advances and achievements. They will say that true communism has never been tried. They will write about Stalinist playwright Lillian Hillman in tones of sympathy and understanding they will never extend to film director Ilya Kazan. I think she's the one responsible for Triumph of the Will. The ultimate consequence of this, writes, and this is back to Nathan, is extremely dangerous, he says, because leftists fail to reckon with the truth about communism. They will end up justifying anything done in the name of the people. They cheered along Venezuela's socialist government as it, and I'm going to put this in quotes too, collapsed into dictatorship and humanitarian ruin, though Nathan puts that in quotes, and people like Bernie Sanders condemn Wall Street without recognizing that efforts to criminalize capitalism and financial services also have predictable results. Yeah, like less evictions. The line running from progressive social commitments to catastrophic economic results is short and straight. All right, first of all, says Nathan, I am not sure how many millennial hipsters Brent Stevens spends time around. I certainly haven't met him, but I tend to see very few of them in Mao Zedong t-shirts. But my birthday is coming up, guys. Rather than honest advocacy in favor of collectivized farming systems, which, you know, I'm partial to, I've only ever encountered one authentic millennial Maoist. But let's just say I don't think that there's a danger he'll be leading the next great cultural revolution. There are two main parts to Stevens' argument. First, the leftists have a double standard, rationalizing communism and failing to appreciate just how bad it was. And second, that if leftists honestly face with the realities of that history, they would see that their criticisms of capitalism can only lead us towards terror and misery. The first point has a little merit. The second is a steaming pile of manure. Much of what Stevens categorizes as rationalization is nothing of the kind. There is an actual difference between racial hatred and class hatred. Here it is. And it's an important one. Race is an immutable characteristic, while class isn't. If I'm a rich landlord, one that simply buys land and doesn't manage it, I can stop being a rich landlord any day of the week by simply giving all of my property away. It's much more fair to hate someone for something they do than for some aspect of themselves they cannot change. And hatred of the rich stems from the fact that rich people, through their actions, make the world more unjust. Whenever people who have a lot of money make the silly argument that prejudice against the wealthy is the same as a prejudice against Jews, they imply that rich people can't help but be selfish. Poor them. But it's good to remind them that they could cease to be victims of this prejudice any time they like. Stevens also suggests that saying communism remains a sound theory, or has never been tried, amounts to an apology for 20th century dictatorships of the left-wing kind. I think here he misunderstands what the actual argument is, at least a more sensible version of it, kind of, I would make. When anyone points out to me that the Soviet Union or Castro's Cuba and says, well, that's your socialism, my answer isn't, well, they didn't try hard enough. It's that these regimes bear absolutely no relationship to the principle for which I am fighting. They weren't egalitarian in any sense. They were dictatorships, or at least top-down states. Thus, to say, well, look at the disaster. Look what a disaster an egalitarian society is to mistake the nature of the Soviet Union. The history of these states shows what is wrong with authoritarian societies in which people are not actually equal, and shows the fallacy of thinking you can achieve egalitarian ends through authoritarian means. This is precisely what Orwell was trying to demonstrate with his novels, though almost everybody seems to have missed his point. Orwell was, in fact, a committed socialist, but he knew that socialism was about giving workers ownership, collective ownership, democratic ownership, which they don't have if they're being told what to produce at gunpoint. Animal Farm, which is somewhat required reading, is not about the dangers of socialism, as usually as it's presented. It's about the dangers of using revolution to justify totalitarianism. Not that revolution always is totalitarianism, which is the kind of attitude I encounter from boomers who wish to lecture me on how electoral politics should work or somewhat. So sometimes the kind of straw man's about how, well, you know, saying that, you know, Cuba isn't really communist is like saying America is not really a democracy, or rather the silliness. I had a metaphor in my head or some kind of comparison. But basically, it's snarkier in my head, and I guess I'll write it out later and put it in a comedy act or something. But people who call America a democracy because it's voting, like, you know, well, you vote for president every 4 years, and that's what makes this a democracy. That's the same logic of saying, well, because there is a little bit of, because there's state ownership, or there's some national industry, that's everything about a communist society. We can define that as communist, no bar. That's like saying we're a democracy because we vote for president in every 4 years. When democracy not only is, but can be so much more. Nathan continues. The history of the Soviet Union doesn't really tell us much about communism, if communism, as defined by theory, is a stateless society where people share everything equally. It was a society dominated by the state, in reality, or in practice, which, as described by those who would defend it, say, well, it's a transitionary state in the first place. It's like, it's not, what occurred in the 20th century wasn't the goal, it was the interim. And let's say if the Soviet Union was left to its own devices, without being under attack and have to be in an arms race, if there was no arms race, perhaps by the 21st century there would be a mass democratization movement, right? But from below, as in the 80s there was an environmentalist movement from below in the Soviet Union. But here's some examples of American socialists being consistent and not towing the certain line that many leftists in America did in the 30s and 40s, which kind of becomes like, well, if you're a socialist, you have to defend the Soviet Union. And that meant you would always have to be making excuses for the famine or whatever was being reported on in the Hearst newspapers. This was in the 30s and 40s. And so it made the socialist movements really bad, and they looked inconsistent, even disregarding all of the actual repression that it was occurring from the U.S. government. When Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, these are socialists in America but also anarchists, visited the Soviet Union, they were horrified by the scale of the repression. Liberty, this is quoting Lenin himself, liberty is a luxury not to be permitted at the present stage of development. You know, implying that there would be liberty later, you know, once we actually house and feed everybody, which would take some time, granted. But Goldman concluded that it would be fantastic to consider, it in any sense communistic. Her pamphlet that she wrote after visiting Russia, There Is No Communism in Russia, argues that if the Soviet Union was to be called communist, and by the way, this is in the 1920s, right after the Russian Revolution. But if the Soviet Union was to be called communist, the word must have no meaning. Bertrand Russell visited Lenin and was alarmed by his indifference to human freedom. Russell left disillusioned, not as to communism in itself, but as to the wisdom of holding a creed so firmly that for its sake men are willing to inflict widespread misery. Lenin himself acknowledged that he was implementing a form of state capitalism. The primary lesson here is not about egalitarianism or socialism, or even communism, or any isms, since Castro, Mao, Stalin, and Lenin did not actually attempt to implement any or many of those ideas. I would argue they implemented something. Instead, the lesson is about what happens when you have a political ideology that contains a built-in justification for any amount of horrific violence. The bad part of Marxism is not the part that says workers should cease to be exploited, but the part about the dictatorship of the proletariat. The dominant communist tendencies of the 20th century aimed to liberate people, but they offered no actual ethical limits on what you could do in the name of that liberation. That doesn't mean liberation is bad. It means ethics are indispensable, and that the Marxist disdain for moralizing is scary and ominous. And by Marxist, he means certain lefties today, who basically say, the left has been beaten by the right in America because we moralize everything, because we're always couching everything into moral arguments instead of financial numbers, quote-unquote rational arguments. But that false dichotomy, you can do both. Or you could have certain spokespeople who have moral arguments and they're moral leaders, and then you have others who make financial and so-called rational arguments based on efficiency. And I'll basically be doing both throughout this program, as I already have through the hour almost. So I'm going to have to speed this up, but I did want to read at least all of this one. It is actually important, then, to do precisely what Stephens condemns, to distinguish advantages and achievements from indefensible atrocities. If your society manages, as socialist states in the 20th century did, have impressively low infant mortality and impressively high literacy, but tortures political prisoners, we might want to adopt your literacy program while declining to recreate your secret police. But I am capable of holding two ideas in my head at the same time. And do not think in caveman-like grunts of this is good or this is bad. I can draw distinctions between the positive and negative aspects of a political program or even a person. I like the bit about allowing workers to reap greater benefits from their labor. I don't like the bit about putting dissidents in front of firing squads. And it seems to me as if an intelligent person ought to be capable of disintegrating those things and seeing that you can be in favor of readjusting a balance of wealth without being in favor of show trials and purges. Conservatives see a necessary connection between these things. Just look at movies like The Purge, I guess. But ironically enough, this is because they don't actually know much about history. And the long tradition of libertarian socialists who have been critical of totalitarian thinking from the very beginning. Here's a quote from Bakunin, a Russian anarchist. This is a critique that Bakunin made of Marx during his lifetime. They were contemporaries. Exactly predicted the nature of the Soviet Union decades before it came about. Because these figures argued with each other in their own time in the same salty way they people do on Twitter today. Quoting Bakunin, Marxists insist that only dictatorship, of course their own, can create freedom for the people. We reply that all dictatorship has no objective other than self-perpetuation, and that slavery is all it can generate and instill in the people who suffer it. Freedom can be created only by freedom, by a total rebellion of the people. and by a voluntary organization of those people from the bottom up. Kunin said that strong states of the kind advocated by Marx and Marxists would eventually produce military and bureaucratic centralization. And that the only difference between this kind of government, again, this is from like 1860s, 70s, 150 years ago. Let's see, the only difference between the kind of government and a monarchy is that in a monarchy oppresses and robs the people in the name of the king, while a proletarian dictatorship does it in the name of the people. But he said the people will feel no better if the stick with which they are being beaten is labeled the people's stick. Bakunin himself was often loathsome, anti-Semite in his own right, with violent tendencies. But again, this is the magic of thoughtful reasoning. I am able to accept the sensible parts of his writings and discard the insane ones. The most objectionable part of Stephen's case is his suggestion that criticism of Wall Street is a step down the road to the gulag, and that progressive social commitments necessarily lead to economic catastrophe. Gulags only become possible if you have an ideology like Leninism that justifies gulags. If you are a leftist like Bertrand Russell, oh, and something that probably come up in the next half hour, but I'll point out now since it's in front of me, is I don't think the gulags and the firing squads are justified by the ideology as much, but by, as even Marx would put it, the material conditions. Like, you're fighting a civil war. It's ugly. It's brutal. It's messy. And let's say your enemy is out there committing war atrocities of their own. I think I'm thinking of the kind of little micro policy of the death penalty. When the Bolsheviks took power, they abolished the death penalty. But it was only in a few years that they reinstated it. Because, as they put it, they needed to kill the Tsar. Because they had him in custody, but royalist forces were committing war atrocities out in the countryside, just as the Bolshevik army was, but, you know, it's two sides, both committing war atrocities, because it's war, and obviously one side wants to put a stop to the other, and so they reinstated the death penalty to kill the Tsar and his family, because they were symbols. Ethically, in hindsight, wrong, but when you're fighting a civil war, you know, God damn it all. If you think that's bad, then you should look into what the U.S. government, Lincoln, Grant, and Sheridan did during the Civil War. The South still hasn't gotten over it. But why should they? It's not like we actually made amends. If you're a leftist like Bertrand Russell, leader of the free thought movement in America, who visited Lenin and was disturbed by his lack of interest in liberty, then the conclusion is not that you should stop trying to make the economy more fair, it's that you shouldn't ever be willing to make millions of people miserable in the name of pursuing an ideal. Ideals are still good, but there are still strict limits to be put. Limits. That's a theme that I have. Just as liberté, égalité, fraternité did not become invalid aspirations when Robespierre started cutting off heads, and the Vietnam War didn't discredit the idea of representative democracy, communist atrocities are a warning against committing atrocities, not against fairness. Stephens is right in one respect. There are some on the left who don't think that way. In recent interviews and op-eds about Lenin, a man named Taqiq Ali has praised him for his love of democracy without mentioning the Red Terror, the Cheka stifling bureaucracy that Goldman and Berkman discovered when they first set foot in Lenin's Soviet Union. Because, you know, society is transformed in a few years, right? And that's how it should be judged because, yeah. Because if you visited, and I guess this is what Tocqueville did with America during, you know, a few years after the American Revolution. Actually, no, it was decades later. What am I saying? If you visited America right after the Revolution, it was a complete shit show. I mean, would anyone have anything good to say about the Constitutional Convention and how America was being run at the time? No. I mean, we call it the early Republican years. And there were like 40 years, right, before, say, America figured things out. And it was still then the antebellum, you know, pre-Civil War times. But there were a few decades where it was all over the place. And, yeah, Tocqueville visited America, like, during after 1800. But in the first 20 years, complete mess. I wouldn't judge America on its first 20 years. I wouldn't judge the Soviet Union on its first 20 years. So judge it in the 60s then. It was a vastly different place. But anyway, this is judging America now versus judging America in the 60s. Vastly different place. Anyway, things are always changing is what I'm trying to say. But here we go. Another leftist that kind of Nathan here is criticizing. Terry Eagleton's Why Marx Was Right dismisses worries that Marxism will inevitably be used to justify horrible crimes, essentially by saying that revolutions are never easy, which is what I just did, and power is an inevitable feature of human life, which is very uncomfortable. So I'm not full-throatedly endorsing that. There is some black here in this podcast, and that is, I'll represent that another time. It is of concerning how little time has been spent in analyzing what should be a central question for revolutionary socialists. Question I ask. Which ends would justify which means? And how will you avoid what has happened so many times before when the belief that counter-revolutionaries must be dealt with using, quote, extraordinary measures has led to an escalating cycle of paranoia over who the counter-revolutionaries are? So this is usually what happens. And why I say, like, the French terror after the French Revolution, the Red Terror of Lenin, and so on. But these things exist in democracies as well. Paranoia about the Reds and the terrorists. And now we live in a police state. It was a 20-year transition, but it's happened. People like me were always saying it's happening. I'm certainly not reassured by those who dismiss free speech as a bourgeois liberal value, or who think it applies to everyone but fascists, but lack a clear theory for determining who or is not a fascist, since I could easily be classified as a supporter of free speech for fascists. I could be seen as an enabler, and therefore no better than them. Isn't there a point? Okay. This is the quote one of those lefties. How will you keep this idea that sounds perfectly reasonable from becoming total disaster once implemented? Is an extremely serious question. I'm sorry, this is still Nathan talking. I distrust anyone who doesn't think seriously about the potential consequences of various ideas. And Stephens is right that the history of communist states needs to be taught more. But this also includes the sacrifice they made during World War II, which doesn't get much attention. Any leftism that justifies or downplays atrocities is not for me. It's important to be clear, consistent, and principled. Likewise, I'm sure Stefan, who believes that Soviet atrocities indict socialism, holds the principled and consistent belief that the U.S. support for killing 500,000 Indonesian communists indicts American capitalist democracy, he says with snark. There is no difficulty whatsoever in being an anti-authoritarian socialist. Everyone should be. You should believe in freedom and equality, not just one or the other. Freedom without equality means low-wage servitude, while quality without freedom means living in a police state. Although we live in a police state and there's no equality, so you get the worst of both. Communism, conservative critics are right that it's hypocrisy for any leftist to condemn mass murder while justifying other mass murders committed in the name of the working class. But that's a problem of hypocrisy, not of leftism. You won't find me giving excuses for the Shining Path or the GDR. That's East Germany. But there is no logical reason why that should lead us to endorse callous policies of the American right. Instead, we should be offering a set of ideas that are generally humane, compassionate, and socialist. So to counter that a little bit as I go into two really marginal revolutionary socialist pieces, the phrase of the accomplishments and the positives of socialist states, because these are revolutions, and it's weird what a bad rap revolutions are, because they come with, you know, the spiral of violence, but they do in fact lead to better things for massive amounts of people. So there's a lot of good, the bad, because social change, especially, you know, when it happens quickly, but I would argue that it kind of has to happen quickly. This whole slow, methodical social change, I'm not... There's a case to be made, but I don't hear it made well. I'm like, I'd like to see, like, where is this, right? Because even the slow, like, the examples of, say, recently, gay rights in America. Well, a lot of LGBTQ don't still have full rights in America. They have a little bit more cultural acceptance in cities, but it's still not there yet. There isn't tenant protections fully, job protections. Some states have passed them, but again, just because a law was passed doesn't mean culture has changed. Not to mention all the deaths and the bad stereotypes. And that social change wasn't just because of Will and Grace and positive movie representation, because in the 90s, a lot of representation was still just coded gayness. But it just wasn't... Yeah, just think of all the horror movies where it turns out the murderer was trans or something. But there were riots, there were protests, there was mass mobilization that broke some windows, right? No one was literally killed, oh wait, except for the million people who died of AIDS. So in that case, there was mass violence of a type, but it was more by negligence, and it was on the side of the government. I reference a documentary, How to Survive a Plague, which is a wonderful movie. If heartbreaking, but emotionally distraughting. Actually, you know what I will? I'll go anecdotally here. I have in front of me a novel. I'm showing it to the live stream on Facebook that I'm doing. The Dragon's Village, which is an autobiographical novel from a woman named Yuan Chung Chen. And it's about her... So, if you don't know the story, Mao took all the college-educated graduates and whatever and have you from the cities, like Shanghai, where she's from, and sent them to the countryside. A, to work with the peasant farmers, learn from them, learn of their struggles and their problems, as well as implement the policies from the central authority, you know, Beijing. Still called Peking at the time. In this book, it's referred to as Peking, but the capital. And there's a lot of good stuff in this. So... it's her experiences, how, like, you know, she's there to educate people and the trouble she has educating people because, you know, it was a culture shock. She works in the fields and she has a tough time of it, but otherwise gets, you know, she's fine with it. And also just talking about and educating people on the new laws, on the changes being made. So these are the years after, you know, the Great Leap Forward, it's called, you know, the famines and the millions killed by Mao, as our propaganda would put it. Meanwhile, marriage law was passed, ending arranged marriages. Women have freedom to marry as they want. So it's about forming a women's organization to help women do that and to transition away from women being oppressed by men. Because it is a young woman doing all this. The book ends, and this is kind of where, like, things come together, so to speak, because there's a whole chapter about, like, a riot that occurs against the big landlord of the area, because there are the landholders, and they have their mafia-like grip on people. And the book ends with a woman who seemed quiet and seemed to be, you know, on the fence about how things were, but it turns out she was being promised a little paltry piece of land, because you have all these peasants that have no land of their own and their lives are miserable. They're always starving. But one of the big struggles of the book, like, you know, over the course of 2 years, is to organize the land redistribution. Not the collectivization of all the farming, but just giving each of the peasants their own land. And it's a big party, and they all burn the old deeds, their old arrangements with the bullies and the landlords of their area. Now, and then there are some less guilty people, like one of the more educated but smaller farmers. You know, he gets robbed and ransacked. So, you know, as I put it in another show, undisciplined violence towards those that deserve it and those that don't. But it's that kind of undisciplined, that lack of order and chaos that those who are comfortable today fear so much. Any talk of revolution, the first thought comes to mind is I could get killed. Not, you know, my life could be better, especially if I'm part of the crowd, part of the mass party, you know, actually joining in. But it ends with people having, having a party and just the tears in some of their people's eyes, getting the new deed of their land, and how freeing, you know, and basically it's in our own words, so you know it could all be lies, but it's I don't think it would have won awards if it wasn't backed up by some other reporting and such. But the new marriage law and all that stuff. This is the same thing with Napoleon. You know, yeah, he was conquering Europe, but everywhere he conquered, he was loosening the church's grip on people. He was passing laws that liberalized things. Right? So there was violence, but there was also liberalization. So to today, if we were to have a more just society, it's not that, like, there has to be violence. That's not what I advocate for. It's just a acceptance of the unknown of what will occur. And that's not wincing and not turning away when windows get broken. When the oppressed express themselves. If you don't want the oppressed to express themselves through riots, then you, person in power, need to provide a different way of expressing them, of expression. And it's not productive to say, well, you can vote for president every 4 years. Well, that's not cutting it, is it? If it was enough, then there wouldn't be any protests in the first place. But then it becomes kind of that cycle of apathy where, well, the protests are small. It's only these certain people protesting and so on. The protests are small. So everything's pretty good. You know, it's just 5% are miserable, right? But the crisis deepens and the amount who are unhappy and struggling increases by the day. Yeah, so maybe I'll get to these other two later. The other stories I have are shorter. But basically, one is they're both from the UK and Ireland. So I think mass movements seem to have a different energy about them there than in America. But there's things to learn, and there are trends there. For example, one is decrying how there is in younger people, and I'm talking under 30, Zoomers, they don't like being called that. That's totally understandable. I barely like being called a millennial. I'm barely taking that. But the point is, a good portion of them, especially on social media, as they're radicalized, critiquing the system, they are, in fact, defending Stalin and actually overlooking the atrocities. If anything, they're not overlooking them. They are rejecting the narratives about those atrocities because, after all, the media lies. The narratives we've been fed since childhood in our lives have been complete bull. Why should I take these other ones about communist famine seriously? And then you look into the facts yourself and you find that all the reporting on it was not very accurate or from biased sources. And then you're like, well, what even happened? Was it even that bad? And you look into the stats, you know, and then I have a clip in another of my openings where, like, a Fox News host says, like, oh, I lost the Stalin argument. You never expect to be in one because you had this person who's a teenager basically able to say, like, well, the population grew when Stalin was in charge. Is that a sign of mass famine? Which is reductive as hell. There was a famine. It was bad. And it was ethnically based because it was mostly Ukrainians. So, not to reject it happened. It was bad. So, but this piece is about just how toxic it is that there are all of these marginal lefties that are basically defending everything these communist states did, including the ones that remain, like DPRK, North Korea. If feel I have more nuanced take in not, say, apologizing for everything about North Korea, but saying, well, we do have a lot of troops on their border, and it's not like we apologize for bombing their country into the Stone Age and destroying all their infrastructure and leaving them with nothing, and then blaming them for when people starve. I think that's terribly unfair and uncharitable. How else can you not be authoritarian and totalitarian when that's the result of living in a destroyed country? You know, the warlord may take a different shape and have different aesthetics. And sometimes it's also about young people just liking the aesthetics. So basically this person kind of rants and reports on that. So this is a reminder that word of mouth is the best thing you can do to grow this show. This is the Three Left show you're listening to. Leftist reading hours. Like-minded people, leave a review for the show. This show is available on all podcast platforms. A full archive can be found at threelefts.news, along with show notes for every new episode after midsummer. I haven't uploaded in a few weeks now. I've had deep computer trouble. It should be resolved by the end of the week. Then the flood will come, and I will post multiple episodes in a week, in the next week after this one, after my birthday. We're on Facebook and Twitter, Three Left Show. I'm live streaming the show when I do it live on Facebook. Facebook page is Three Left Show. It's also on Twitter. I don't tweet much. I don't really like Twitter. There's many arguments for why not to be on Twitter. Get you more attention, the attention economy, but I'm not really an attention capitalist, as well as a money capitalist. But if you'd like to support the show materially, that means with dollars, I have a Patreon page, and you can become a member there. Money raised there goes to outreach, because I don't really need to spend it on myself. So we're leaving the rat race for the rat sit-in here at the Three Left Show. Now I'm going to take my mid-break. I'm going to play some music and rest my voice. Thank you for joining me.
For what you stole, the people, the land, the diamonds, the gold. Stop the bombing us, Neo Coons, Uncle Tom and us, selling us your empty promises. Your economists propagandizing what time it is. Fuck that digital shit. Back up off our nuts a little bit, and let's take it back to the futuristic. I testify as I'm a testimony witness. These motherfuckers is too sadistic. If you got some melanin, you can get with this. X that, if you hear this, that's the business. Africa, the rightful land up with forefather. What's going on? We are by chief and mother. The king beat will and take away the silver. The take away the one, but not the culture. You take a liberty. Black man a fight for. We want back the land that we forefather. Christopher Columbus was a rascal liar. To be quite precise, he was a frigid robber.
Soon we'll find out who is the real revolutionary.
And I'm back with the second hour of the Three Left Show. Yeah, I'm just going to keep going then. Okay, so is genocide denial anti-imperialist now? How tankies are taking over left book in the London student scene? For some context of background, a tanky is an derogatory term for that kind of leftist. It's kind of that thing where, like, you don't want to be one, so no one identifies as it. But it's basically a tanky is called so because, like, if you defended the Soviet Union when they kind of put down revolts against the central government because they send in the tanks, you know, Tiananmen Square, sending the tanks. Beijing hasn't done so yet with Hong Kong, but it looks like, you know, they were mobilizing armored vehicles. send in the tanks. So if you defend their actions in doing so, saying, you know, it's the people's stick, they are representing the people, so it's justified. That's that. If you say that, that's what makes you tanky. Although I think there's even a bit more defined and nuanced definition, which is like to just like the aesthetics and role play as this, you know, Soviet Union revolutionary thing that I don't do, but many younger and current and people some my age do it. It's kind of like, is it just the aesthetics? And then they're the ones disregarding. So like, you know, that conservative in the New York Times talking about leftists who don't know the history of the Soviet Union, they should be against communism. And but there's it's just like with other punks and hippies, like we're fed a certain culture our whole lives, and when we reach it, we come of age looking for our own identity. We want to basically either do the opposite or do what's different. And the aesthetics of the Soviet Union, which was, you know, defeated and dead, bring it back. You know, freak out your parents. Freak out the adults. I'm not so trite as that, but I do see the appeal. And I do participate slightly, ever so slightly. I mean, I'm wearing a red and black pin, just the color scheme. I haven't covered my page in Hamill and Sickles, but just the fact that I'm kind of throwing a bone to revolution here is probably subversive in its own right and challenging. But there's a way of taking it too far and being very uncritical. So from, it's called freedomnews.org UK, which, you know, anything with freedom in the title makes me think they're right-wing libertarians. So they just might be. But since they do care about using the word anti-imperialist, they might be left-wing too. But maybe they're anarchists. But let's see. It's September 2013, and three people in front of me are reading RT on their MacBook Pro. An unofficial survey showed the majority of Crimea would choose an economic partnership with Russia over the EU. It's not a good start. A boy from Cambridge I don't know what that word is. He brought, in something that he brought from the Cam and Locke whips, his head around when he hears what he thinks is a Russian name called on the register. He later tells me if he could marry any nationality, it would be Russian. I don't smile at him. I tell him I don't have a Russian citizenship, and he leaves me alone. There's some really weird anecdotes with this. But it's illustrative, I guess, of a broader cultural phenomenon. The London Marxist Society is here handing out flyers, and their header is a picture of Mount Rushmore with the stone faces of Lenin, Marx, Stalin, and Putin. Yeah. If this isn't baffling enough, these symbols are followed with the words, "Down with imperialism." Later, we all go to Lexington. There's a pub quiz where the team with the funniest name wins a bag of Doritos. When the names are handed in, the man with the microphone is astounded that 6 out of 10 are called Crimea River. It's weird and almost as disappointing as the Doritos being cool original. When it's 2017 and I'm standing outside the SOAS, I don't know what that is, with Jonathan Leif of the Workers' Revolutionary Party, a candidate for office, he comes over to us. He begins badly. "Hey, gorgeous ladies." So there's some misogyny there. He hands us a leaflet for a symposium celebrating the 100th anniversary of the February Revolution. The first outrage, it costs £48. And tells me that they want more women involved in their movement because, after all, it was in 1917 Petrograd where sexism met its final demise. He turns to my friend, a Morocco woman, and adds, "You know, the revolution was also to defeat racism in the modern world." So, very silly. I know the Soviet aesthetic is edgy and quirky, and kids like to have a Hamler and Sickle as their Twitter names, as some vaporwave Stalin cover photo. Soviet tower blocks look cool, I know. The USSR was important and fascinating. Gulag jokes and genocide denial look less cool. What looks like an innocent weeaboo 2.0 aesthetic of Stalin's face and a glitch filter with a deeply misapplied acrylic letters has become a cover story for the denial and appropriation as well as the revision of a history which has been set in the minds of Eastern Bloc for centuries. The age of left book has, and the left book is just leftists on Facebook, has brought explicit prohibitions on racist, transphobic, homophobic, oh boy, what a list here, colorist, biphobic, meaning against sexually bi people, basically rejecting that anyone can be bi. So it's like, look, you can be gay, but it just has to be one or the other. Either you have sex with women or men. If you do both, that's too confusing, and I hate it. As well as anti-Semitic behavior, even. Yet only a handful of groups ban this tankism. Plenty of users... So generally, culturally, how it expresses itself. So the tankies online are just they're like the alt-right, and there's kind of a back and forth between them. It's like it's as been said, it's very easy to go from a reactionary right-winger to this type of reactionary leftism, where the goals change, but the underlying cultural attitudes of misogyny and condescension to marginalized people is still there. They haven't unlearned being a toxic person. They just changed, quote-unquote, sides. But a lot of us, like myself, would say they're not on our side. They're trying to... Maybe they're on their own side, a side that apparently praises Putin, because basically the logic is this, that American imperialism is bad. So anyone who is countering that, may it be China and Russia as countries, regardless of who's leading them, being the closest military powers, they are the heroes in global politics. So if China's new line is, we are, you know, branching out and investing everywhere in the world to counter American power, there is part of me, as well as this other group, that cheers that. To say, like, it's about time someone stood up to America without implying that, China isn't about to fly planes into our skyscrapers. In fact, they have not done such a thing. They have not attacked us in any way, which is kind of what makes them the good guys, is that the U.S. is always sailing its ships around and bombing and drone striking people, and China hasn't. They'll drive the tanks and the protesters, sure, but at least that's internal. That's like keeping their own house in order, right? And when it's America, it's capitalism doing this. In China, it's the people's sticks, so it's better. Maybe not perfect, but better. It's tortured logic, for sure. We're getting into a screed against it. Those boys from the home countries who fetishize the Eastern Bloc, deeming any critique of Soviet communism as U.S. imperialist propaganda, or refusing to listen to anyone who experienced Soviet colonialism themselves, the same ones who shout, "Religion only causes wars," from beneath their fedoras while defending the secular ideology which calculatedly burned Muslims out of the Caucasus, referring to Soviet Union war atrocities, without war, actually. Because their Soviet socialism doesn't leave space for the religious, the ones who are rightly calling out imaginaries of slavery and the Holocaust and veganism campaigns, while in the same breath firing out gulag jokes from every platform. They're anti-vegan. The ones who think Stalin fought off the Nazis because he hated racism so much, the Twitter accounts constantly fantasizing about lining up their ideological opposites against the wall and sending them to gulags while insisting that the Soviet state did not use any excessive violence. So there's this kind of thing where, like, oh no, I'm just ironically shitposting. But it's like, well, you can't ironically be a Nazi. If you're putting out all this toxic behavior and stuff, that's what you are. Schrodinger's Marxists insist that communism ought not to be reduced to the views and actions of totalitarian leaders while shutting down those who deny to criticize them. It is more damaging to try to defend the actions of extreme war criminals associated with left movements than to critique them, to develop our own views, and move on. I kind of understand why some lefties would feel defensive about the USSR. It is all too often used as a litmus test of all left-leaning morality. Communists must be sick to death of trying to justify state communism, given the terrible attempts we've seen so far. As much as I wish we had been given a great example of living communism, we haven't. Only when we accept that can we work to make it happen in a better way. It does not undermine the ideology of communism or socialism, and even Marxist-Leninism, to accept that Stalin did in fact do a bunch of stuff wrong. To counter this meanable line, Stalin did nothing wrong. And yes, they actually like post that. Ironically or unironically. A history which no longer matters, apparently. Yeah, so some of them kind of, so there's the attitude of like, it's in the past, let it go, which of course, well, that's what right-wingers say about slavery. So yeah, a lot of toxic stuff happening. So again, about like, seeing Russia and Putin's Russia in particular as an oppressed underdog, which needs its name and reputation protected. It's somehow become impossible to consider that the Russian Federation, it's all in its forms, in the last 20, 30 years, has been little more than a mirror of the U.S. or a lapdog of the U.K. Russia has colonized or attempted to colonize most of Central Asia. It's aligned itself with the cruelest forces in the world, which now includes the USA and the U.K. Throughout each of its eras, it has systematically cleansed itself of religious and ethnic minorities. It's fully terrible, and it is imperative that all tankies reevaluate their priorities. And by tankies, it means all lefties, really. But these toxic guys, individual, and yes, they all, mostly all guys, reevaluate their priorities and direct their dubious critical thinking capacities elsewhere. Leave this mess behind. Tanky discourse is over for me. I'm not engaging in it anymore. It surrounds a set of ideological reference which respond to nothing in the living or dead world. It is a toxic network of arguments, counter-arguments, based on unfounded claims and empty accusations of propaganda. I've read from what could be termed tanky discourse. In fact, I could just do that right now by reading the piece from that I skipped over from the last hour by Fergal Tomwy, an Irish communist who I will just put in the show notes. And it's called Trotskyism Today in Cold War Hysterics. Basically about how another faction in, left-wing activists. And again, it's like a few dozen leftists and another few dozen leftists arguing with each other about their positions. And some of those, and it basically goes back to the Cold War, where a lot of leftists embrace kind of Trotsky because he was exiled from the Soviet Union. So it gave a lot of other leftists at the time an excuse or a reason to distance themselves from the Soviet Union. Because like, look, we hate Stalin. But then they become the banner holders of what leftism is supposed to be since the Soviet Union, quote unquote, failed. It didn't fail in many respects. They had a better space program than us for a while. And from where they started, an agrarian, barely industrialized society, it's quite a leap. A lot of progress with some famine along the way. And guess what? If you think American history is free of that, you're sadly mistaken. Okay, so let's spend the rest of the hour going back to... Yeah, so let's continue with this from a organization that could be mischaracterized as being tanky. I think there are just some tankies in it. So this is from The Socialist, the official publication of the Socialist Party U.S. And it is called Why the U.S. Spreads Lies About China. So it's an op-ed doing the very thing I just kind of threw out. So I guess I'm just going back and forth. But that's kind of what that's the goal here. Like, I'm not taking a solid position myself, so to speak. What I'm doing is I'm representing these somewhat opposed, wild ways of looking at the world. Wild from a mainstream perspective. But I think the more you expose yourself to the wild, either you can feel more smug in your centrism or whatever you have. Or you're like, well, we don't want to change the status quo too much. We just want to get rid of redistricting. Which, you know, good goal, I guess. But it's not going to solve everything. But it's a kind of piece about, like, the narrative that our media creates about China and other socialist states. But let's go through it, and then I'll clarify where I'm going with this. It starts with a foreword on their statement on two recent articles. This is written by Rainer Shea. It's remarkable how much of the propaganda that America creates about China feels like projection. The U.S., which frequently censors dissenting voices, persecutes Muslims and disfavored ethnic groups, is controlled by an oligarchic corporate regime and keeps half of its own people in poverty, perpetuates the largest empire in history, due to military spending and such, is accusing China of all of these atrocities itself. This accuse your enemy of what you are guilty strategy is useful for America's goals in China, which is to destroy a power that's threatening to ruin its quest for a global hegemony. Communist China has been an obstacle to the American empire right from the start, with China having fought on the side of North Korea, DPRK, amid America's genocidal invasion of Korea. It's now continuing its role as a bulwark against imperialism by working to protect Venezuela from a potential invasion as well, by backing Syria in its fight against U.S.-backed terrorists, referring to Daesh and the moderate rebels, which are backed by Saudi Arabia. So it's, you know, proxy war. And by remaining loyal to North Korea as the capitalist world rages war against it. So as China continues to move towards, because we still don't have a peace agreement, you know. So as China continues to move towards becoming a world's dominant power itself, America has every reason to sabotage it. The propaganda aspect of the sabotage effort, ironically, depends on painting China as the exact kind of imperialist menace that the U.S. is. I debunked many of the lies that make up this false image of China in one of my many articles from last month, but that essay requires a second volume. Here, I'll cover the fraudulence of the major concepts about China that is instilled into Westerners. I'll do some counterpoints maybe after during this. So first, here's the thing about Tibet. Now, currently, I have pointed out in one of my ecology episodes how Tibet is, in fact, being strip-mined for lithium, for all those solar panels, as well as all that pink Himalayan salt. It was mentioned to me. It's easy to miss. You know, you just gloss, your eyes just go glassy in the grocery store, and you see all this pink Himalayan salt. Like, does the Himalayas really have that much salt to cover all our potato chips in pink salt? And, you know, and all the facial creams and the beauty products that use pink salt. And yeah, like, if you want a free Tibet, or if you think Tibet is being oppressed by China and being imperialized, then why would you not boycott such products? So anyway, here is big lie number one. China is imperialist, from The Defender. Once again, the irony of America's propaganda against China is absurd. The U.S. constantly wages wars of imperialist aggression under the false pretense of liberating its victim nations. And when China actually intervenes in another country in order to free it, the U.S. characterizes this as being imperialism. China's intervention in Tibet, it's 1951, wasn't just supported by a wide range of Tibetans and motivated by a desire to free the country from the horrors of its feudal system. It was followed by a series of U.S. actions in Tibet that were truly imperialist and unjustifiable. In response to the revolution that China brought to Tibet, the CIA began a campaign of agitation, funding and arming anti-Chinese Tibetan factions, and dirty political tricks which led to a U.S.-manufactured uprising in Tibet against the country's new government. Now, this is kind of something, quote-unquote, tankies do, but this line kind of does is, like, any kind of people's or bottom-up movement that occurs, it's disputed whether or not it was grassroots. When there is a local opposition to, say, a socialist state, it's usually spun as being foreign agitation. This cuts both ways, as any socialist movement in America is then painted as being some form of foreign agitation. Now, I don't think I've been personally called a Putin puppet or anything, but I've seen enough of it out there that I'm like, I wonder how long before I'm called an agent of foreign autocrats. Because they are perceived as being left-wing? Because I don't Putin is not left-wing, okay? But if you've seen anyone called a Putin puppet, that's that in action. And tankies seem to do it too. So, like, Tibetans that oppose the military occupation there, most likely. Is it a coincidence? I mean, what's first? You know, is it that there's opposition and then the CIA, seeing an opportunity, arms them? So the, you know, Civil War, say, wouldn't have happened if it weren't for U.S. intervention. But I think the justification that I am sympathetic to is saying that these opposition movements to what socialists do, they're always the formal feudal landowning class that just basically got kicked down a few social rungs in that often feared equal society. How dare I be lumped in with the rest of the peasants? Which is why then they say, like, well, yeah, it brings equality. It makes everyone poor. Like, no, it just makes you less rich. That's the case with Cuba, and it could be the case here, too. Here we go. The point to stress is that there is no repression in Tibetan simply for being Tibetan, nor does the Chinese government repress religion per se. Oh, per se. Instead, Tibetans receive a range of preferential policies, and authorized religions in China receive state support. You just have to be authorized. Oh, boy. Where religious organizations pose no political threat, they are regulated by the state. So, you know, as long as you're not posing a threat, right? Of course, who's to say who poses a threat or not? The state. So it's top down, and I'm not really for it. Let's see. Big lie number two. And I think, like, I'm going to sum this up in my way that every bad thing China does, and this is a kind of a whataboutism, is like everything that makes China totalitarian can be said about America. So to me, being consistent is to take the kind of anarchist line and say that all state power is toxic, that all top-down governance is oppressive and abusive, and that the very things that we don't like about China, Russia, whatever, Soviet Union, and other socialist states, are the same critiques that can be leveled against the U.S. government. You know, the when putting down riots and protests, the restrictions of civil liberties via Patriot Act, and in the name of security and the war on terror and fighting enemies, those deemed a threat to the American government. I could be put in that category very easily. I haven't been yet, thankfully. You know, their government is just, all their news is propaganda, lies. Well, what about our fucking our propagandic media? Remember WMDs in Iraq? That's what this article points out. Let's see, in my last China article, I detailed how the network of Chinese human rights defenders has used the money it receives from Western governments to spread baseless claims which reinforce the completely fabricated narrative that China is holding millions of Muslims in concentration camps. I've since learned that another Chinese opposition group called China Tribunal has propagated similarly suspect claims about the Chinese government harvesting organs from prisoners, even as they've released their final judgment and report about this allegation. They apparently haven't even been able to publish the full report on their findings, which supposedly contains all the evidence they need to support their assertions. All of these charges against China, along with the misleadingly presented Western portrayals of China's Orwellian social credit system, by the way, we have a credit system as well, it's called a credit check. You can't get a bank loan without it. You can't get a college loan without it. It literally, like, actually, I've encountered landlords that won't rent to you unless you have good credit, right? So you can't even, you could be homeless because you don't have good credit score. And the credit scores are determined by these rating agencies. They're really not accountable. They're accountable to the banks and those that use the credit scores to judge whether or not you are worth loaning to or giving any resources to, because it's capitalism. So China has a social credit system, which is like a credit report, but it's socially based, more or less. And if you think that's bad and wrong, which, good case to be made, then so is credit scores. Here's another, let's see, big lie of the U.S. government. China isn't on the side of the world's poor or working people. It's always been a strategy of the capitalist class to make the poor and working people hate socialist political leaders and movements, which are actually fighting in their interests. The myth that the Soviet Union and Mao's China weren't really socialist has worked as a way to stop people from trying to emulate any Marxist development in these countries. The same deceptive practice is now being applied in modern China. For example, headlines like China's leaders confront an unlikely foe, ardent young communists, and is China's version of capitalism winning? Are representative of the perspective about China's economic system that always seems to be presented. The old red-baiting propaganda approach isn't what's now used to demonize China, but rather an era that China is a now plutocratic dystopia, where workers are oppressed by a fraudulently socialist regime. Irony is again found in the fact that America is ruled by such a plutocracy. My last essay about China refutes the talking points that claim China is capitalist, including the one which involves China's treatment of Marxist students. The reason why these talking points hold such prominence in Western capitalist-influenced media outlets and academic circles is clear. The capitalist class wants to break international worker solidarity with the Communist Party of China. This theory is supported by the fact that China holds a gargantuan amount of national resources and wields vast propaganda power, which it's using for the worldwide anti-capitalist movement. And it lists a bunch of examples of, military projection, of power. So I'm not going to... I'm reading this with a grain of salt myself. Because although just that, don't believe everything you read. And yet there are many, even nominally on the left, that will, agree. Government, U.S. is a plutocracy, ruled by the rich. We have a media that is corporate and completely controlled by the rich, by advertising, by megacorps. We have a government that is bought and corrupt by megacorps and the 1%. To use that rhetoric, the 1%, the rich, the billionaires, and the millionaires. And yet, when that very same media that lies us into war with Iraq, that pumps fear into us with the war on terror and whatever else, and has currently spent the last 3 years talking about Russiagate and how we're going to bring down Trump and fascism with voting and legal circus hearings in Congress, then says China has set up Muslim concentration camps and is a dystopian nightmare, and we're meant to believe that. I'd be very skeptical of all of that. Not to say that there's no truth or there's nothing happening whatsoever. This guy's coming from that place, and I'm skeptical of that. But he makes a good point that there is, in fact, a fight happening between our government and the Chinese government. And where the anarchist position is where I'm like, taking from there, is that these are geopolitical nation states. Sorry, these are nation states fighting out geopolitically on the global stage. And as workers and as people trying to live our lives, it's really none of our business. By that I mean it has nothing to do with us. Actually, that's probably the wrong way of putting it. What I mean is we shouldn't give a damn about it. We only have a horse in the race between the U.S. and China if you're nationalistic. But my sympathies lie with the working people of China and America. And we're, let's say, evidence to say we are both being oppressed. Those are the facts, right? That the workers in Chinese factories making the iPhones without breaks, they need to be unionized just as much as workers here. Difference is that in China, at least in the last 5 years, since they've kind of reached their production goals, so to speak, because being a centrally planned economy, they could say, okay, now we're going to grant labor rights. Now everyone should unionize. I'll have to investigate and maybe do a story on unionization in China and how things are getting better. And they're taking down the suicide nets. No need for suicide. It's not a hellscape anymore. But I'm sure in some aspects, it still is. Things don't change overnight. But here in America, things are still very tough. Unionization is still, it's sometimes criminalized. Or it's criminalized within the large companies. Amazon, for example. It's uncouth to say you're against unionizing, but you'll say like, well, we're not for unionizing. and they'll say like, and they'll basically, like the orientation video will be like, if you see dissatisfied coworkers talking about unionizing, tell your manager. So the question, why does the U.S. spread lies about China, or at least half-truths, let's be charitable, is that we're in competition with them. Capitalist competition with them. So as communist as China says it is or wants to be, whatever, it's still in competition with the U.S. You could take it as empire against empire. Okay. So if we're not for that, we're not for what China does, shouldn't be for what the U.S. does. We build our own anti-nationalist, meaning internationalist, movement and governance, separate, independent of these bullies. See, I have a story. I think I'll spend the next 10 minutes and the last 10 minutes on a story about Hong Kong. I'll have to summarize this as well. This is from The Gray Zone, a blog of sorts. And it's called the DSA Jacobin Haymarket Sponsored Socialism Conference features U.S. government-funded regime change activists. So this goes into the nitty-gritty details, but I'm going to summarize here that American socialists, you know, the rising DSA, you know, AOC and another, you know, the squad, as they're called, and Jacobin, too, which, like Foreign Affairs, which I started with, says we're socialists and we're anti-authoritarian. And that means we Cuba and China sucks. But more like everything about them sucks, and we want U.S. intervention. So it talks about how, like, at the 2019 Socialism Conference, this is like the capital S Socialism Conference, which is pretty, there's more than one, but DSA and Jacobin and Haymarket, which is a book publisher, has, they're putting out the Socialism Conference, and they have all these tracks and panels with these student leaders. And for the most part, all of these socialists and Jacobin is like this. They have a line that is described as anti-communist. That we're not like, and this is to them, even maybe even privately will admit, that this is a tactic in talking to the American public. Communism has such a bad rap that it has baggage in the minds of boomers and Gen Xers. It's gulags, firing squads, and famine come to mind. Rightfully or irrightfully. I think when you think of the British Empire, famine should come to mind. As someone of Irish descent, famine comes to mind when I think of the British Empire. Just as, you know, when you think of America, slavery could come to mind. So, you know, but they have a line that, like, you know, we can't use the C word, communism, and so we need to not only distance ourselves, we need to red bait ourselves. We need to say communism sucks. We're still socialists, but all these other lefties that are, they're doing it wrong, right? Even though they've actually taken government power and have, say, as mentioned, raised literacy and lowered infant mortality. And unionization is widespread. There are government-endorsed unions, so if you try to unionize outside of it, I guess you're in trouble. Okay, that's bad. But still, there's accomplishments to recognize. And there are these socialists that don't seem to want to do that, and they just kind of paint with a broad brush, and they reduce 20th century socialism to an amount of errors, so the 21st century socialism will be completely different. And not learn anything from them, because there's nothing to learn, apparently, except not to be authoritarian, as Nathan put it in the first article. But what it sometimes turns into a strategy is to then be completely electoral, join the Democratic Party, vote blue no matter who, and whatnot. Even though DSA, that's uncharitable. They voted to, you know, Bernie or bust. You know, yeah, we're endorse Bernie as a Democrat. But we won't endorse anyone else. We'll only endorse socialist candidates, they say. And thus, they will endorse Cynthia Nixon for New York governor, who identified herself once as a democratic socialist. But as far as policy and life goes, not. So they're trying to merge the largest U.S. socialist organizations together. Mentions the tickets are like $105, though they do have a solidarity rate. It mentions that many anti-communist organizations use the clenched fist symbol, which I feel like, well, I like the clenched fist symbol, and I think it doesn't mean that to me. Talks about the ISO, which is the kind of main U.S. Trotskyist organization, though this site uses Trotskyite. You have anti-China workers' rights groups, but they're funded by anti-labor U.S. groups. And you have these student leaders, which are paid or bankrolled or supported by the National Endowment for Democracy, covered them in the past, or at least maybe I was thinking of using this video. And basically, they're an arm of the CIA, or they're an arm of the U.S. elite, the millionaires and the billionaires. You know, they give their money to this endowment for democracy, and then they fund these liberal groups. And they are liberal groups. Their goals are liberal reforms, you know, multi-party elections. And by that, we mean a two-party election system. Like ours, like America, because our election system, it's so great, right? We want to, everyone else should have a government just like ours. Is that what really we want for the rest of the world? U.S. democracy? I don't, come on. As bad as whatever you project other places to be, to wish our system on them needs to be reconsidered. So it goes in all that. Karen, I'm just summarizing here. Summarizing an article, bashing the DSA, but pretty much just not the DSA itself and everything they do. Because some aren't electoral at all. Some are just about unionizing and educating, which is what I do. And but just pointing out this this spot here where like they're featuring anti-socialist, you know, liberal groups. Because they are anti-communist, and they want to show how anti-communist they are. For the benefit of, I don't know, appealing to suburban Americans. But some of these are, like, almost near fasci groups. You know, they're just anti-socialists. Some are, like, neocon groups. Let's see. Reports that, you know, they cite Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and other neocons. Or rather, these same groups meet with neocon senators, you know, and they call any socialist organization in their home country tyrannous, authoritarian. That's all you have to do. And then bam, as Americans, we hate them, now, whether they be Venezuela and El Salvador, so on, or China. This one is shorter, but okay, I'm going to spend the last 10 minutes finishing up with a thing about Hong Kong by a Singapore diplomat and pretty much apparatchik of the neoliberal capitalist order. So this is from that perspective. But I think he makes some good points about the unrest in Hong Kong that I didn't make last week. So his name is Abira Kausakan. So the subtitle is, as I write this, demonstrations in Hong Kong continue. This is written in, like, last month. There's been developments. Although the extradition bill that sparked them has been shelved, this is the latest phase of protests that began in 2014 with Occupy Central, or the Umbrella Movement. The proximate causes may be different, but they all arise from a disquiet of many Hong Kong people with Beijing's sway. I do not know when the demonstrations will end, but I am quite certain about what they will achieve. Absolutely nothing. Spoken like a true elite. I can understand the disquiet of the Hong Kong people subject to a China that under Xi Jinping has increasingly stressed the control of the Communist Party over every sphere of life in China, and not just in Hong Kong. But Hong Kong lost that battle even before it began. Ever since the end of the Qing Dynasty in the late 19th century, the legitimacy of Chinese governments, imperial, republican, or communist, has rested on the ability to defend China's sovereignty and its borders. I don't think Beijing is eager to exercise direct control over Hong Kong, but the unity of China is not a matter of compromise. The Hong Kong people, and the West generally, may have thought that the emphasis on one country, two systems, a slogan that lay on the second phrase, but for Beijing, it was clearly always one country. I shall not speculate about whether there was any real coincidence between what Britain's leaders privately believed in 97, when they turned Hong Kong over, and what they now say they believe, what they believed at the time. Beijing was willing to tolerate two systems provided it did not undermine one country. But this is precisely what the demonstrators, particularly those that have resorted to violence in defiance of the law, are now doing. Again, speaking as an elite neoliberal guy. I, for one, am supportive of unrest and breaking of property. Because the rent is too damn high. And it's lowering rent, as I said in the last episode. Beijing will not act precipitously. It has bigger and more immediate domestic problems to deal with, like the trade war with the U.S. Beijing can wait on Hong Kong. After all, where can it go? And which foreign country will offer more than token or rhetorical support to these demonstrators? After all, a lot of the demonstrators are just expressing populist concerns about the rent and about their standard of living, as well as just general opposition to the police state and mass surveillance. I mean, these are things liberals don't really care about. They justify it. The Hong Kong people are used to thinking of themselves as the center of their own universe. Perhaps this is a delusion inherited from the British. But what the demonstrators have failed to understand is that Hong Kong is no longer unique. He explains that it's just now another Chinese, large Chinese city, as there are many other Chinese cities, Chengchong and Shanghai, that are now big port cities. And in fact, and the prosperity that Hong Kong has enjoyed over the 20th century is its rule of law, you know, as he puts it. The West generally sees the issue as the Hong Kong people demanding more rights and democracy. Typically, was the headline on the article in the New York Times. Hong Kong protesters are fueled by a broader demand. More democracy. Perhaps they do want more democracy. I applaud that idealism and courage of young demonstrators. But he doubts their common sense. Let's see. He explains that throughout British rule, it really wasn't democratic. It just had governance. And that, you know, British governments led, the people of Hong Kong are now citizens of China, not of the British Empire. The rights they enjoyed as a British colony, emphasis on colony, were not very different from what were granted under one country, two systems. So things haven't really changed that much. But what Hong Kong really needs is not more democracy, as a good liberal would put it, but better governance. That's a standard neoliberal line. We don't need more democracy, we just need the right people in charge. Good governance requires political representation for sure, but the terms are not synonyms, as this man puts it. Underlying the frustration that fuels the demonstrations is a loss of confidence of many Hong Kong youth in their future. No shit. So he goes on, points out that Hong Kong and Singapore are kind of rivals. Let me move on here. Never mind. He speaks as someone, a leader in Singapore, which I don't really care about. Because Singapore has a lot of good stats going for it, but its government is also pretty authoritarian. But they're also a much smaller country. So, like, and this is, like, the thing. Like, Singapore's government has a very capitalist, but it's also very planned. Like, all their health care and housing. So, like, the capitalism is laissez-faire, right? But the housing and the health care is socialized. Or socialistic. It's all public. So it's kind of the case of like the social democratic case of like once you provide all of the basics, then capitalism can run rampant. It's still a big problem for all of Singapore's neighbors because all of those negative externalities, pollution, what have you. It's still bad for the world. But at least locally speaking, Singapore has it good because they're wealthy. Whatever. I guess the same could be said of Florida. Florida looks really nice when you're there, but then there's all of the environmental loss and then a hurricane hits you. So yeah, so no big wrap-up conclusion to all that. But I think that's kind of where I want to leave you. Just the mess of thoughts and perspectives that makes up our world today. But I want to remind you that this show is podcasted, so you don't have to listen to it live in that way. It's found on the major podcasting apps, and I hope to be on more. And when I mentioned my show to someone, they said, well, is it on Spotify? If it isn't, I'm not listening to it. Okay, great. I guess people are stuck where they are. Live in your little app prison. To support the show more materially, visit our Patreon page, Three Left Show, on Facebook and Twitter and Patreon. The website, threelefts.news, where a full backlog of episodes can be found. So thank you very much for listening. I'm just going to go with that.